Good evening and welcome to Shattered Lives. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, and we here at the Shattered Lives radio program are very excited to welcome you to this unique show, particularly if this is your first time around. Taking you beyond the details of the crime and the perpetrator, getting to the heart of what crime victim families experience and what they need in the aftermath of the crime. Prior to the show, please go to www.donnagore.com and imaginepublicity.com to read the background of the case or organization featured the week before each show is aired. And please, please don't forget that in case you can't tune in live from 5 to 6 Eastern, you can always listen at any time on our archival feature. So good evening. I'm welcoming everybody. This is Donna Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, on Saturday, May 5th, and promising you a wonderful show as always. And prior to our guests, I'm joined by our other weekend warrior, the person I make work on the weekend because I have another job in the maven of media, the wonderful Delilah Jones, president of Imagine Publicity. Welcome, Delilah. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. I really like being a maven. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, well, you are a lot of things to those of us who are clients of yours. And, you know, I just wanted to mention that although you're based in Myrtle Beach, you have clients across the entire U.S., don't you?
I do, and a lot of very, very wonderful people. And I learned so much from each and every one of them. And I've worked with Lavinia for quite some time now, and it's been great to get to know her and as well as other people and the different work that everyone does. It's so hard to not get yourself immersed in what other people are doing, and sometimes it gets overwhelming, but it all works out. And I've been very fortunate to be able to become not just, with a client relationship, but a lot of friendships as well.
Well, we too have had that honor with you too, and we certainly view you as a friend. And I just wanted to know before we bring people in, because I'm usually not shy, but I'm a little shy about my accomplishments. And I just wanted to know from your perspective, if this is for people's first time listening to Shattered Lives, what is it that you would tell them about Shattered Lives that you like so far, as we have a track record from February?
We do have a track record, and it's just getting better and better. I think this show, I'm involved with a lot of different people that do radio, and most of them are crime-related. It seems to be Imagine Publicity is kind of a magnet for a lot of crime authors, crime advocates, just, a lot of different types of crime. This show is a little different in that we're not here to bring up a case and pick it apart like they do on Nancy Grace or something, a show like that. You have done such a wonderful job of finding some of the best guests and imparting their information so that the audience and the listeners can really come away with a lot of resources and a lot of information should they ever be in a position like that. And also, I think some of the guests that you've had who've been down that road, they've suffered through a violent crime or something has happened with someone close to them. So it's always nice to hear their stories so that other listeners feel that bond, I guess.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for the compliments, and I have to say that I feel very lucky, and it's a labor of love doing this, and I'm learning so much, and hopefully I'm becoming a better radio host, and I just love the interactive nature. And with that said, why don't we start our four-way interaction today? We're going to try not to talk over each other as little as possible, but if we do, who cares? we've got the topic today is sexual assault, and I'm very pleased to have two people from different geographic realms. One is in my own backyard here in Connecticut, and that's Anna Deragazi, and I hope I pronounced your last name correctly, Anna.
You did.
I did. Oh, good. Well, give me a gold star from Connecticut Sexual Assault Crisis Services, Inc., and it's a consortium of individual programs dealing with those who have experienced sexual violence. And they do a wonderful job and have many innovative programs. And all the way down there in Texas, we've got Lavinia Masters. And it's the first time for me to meet her live and in person, and certainly an honor. Lavinia is, come on in, Lavinia, and join the crowd here. How are you?
I'm wonderful. Thanks for asking, and thanks for having me on your show. It is an honor and a privilege to share with your listening audience today.
Well, thank you. Back at you. And I want to let people know, in case they didn't get to read the entire promo information, that you are founder of SAVE Ministries. And can you tell us what that acronym is, and a little bit about your background, and then we'll get into some other things.
Okay. Well, the SAVE Ministry stands for Sexual Abuse Assault Victim Empowering Ministry. And it's basically a ministry that I feel was breathed into me by God to empower other survivors of sexual abuse and sexual assault, any sexual violence that has occurred in their lives. And I was given this assignment because I myself am a survivor of sexual assault. At the age of 13, I was brutally raped inside my home. Someone broke into our home and raped me at knife point. And for over 20 years, I had no idea who it was, or where he came from, why he chose me, why he did what he did to me, and left me there in the world of chaos, confusion, and trauma. But thankfully, for DNA, which I call a footprint from God, was left over 20-something years ago. In modern technology today, we were able to find my perpetrator, who committed this heinous crime to me, and it has given me a whole new perspective of life. And as I titled my book, Breathe Again, it has allowed me to breathe again, to exhale all the poisonous natures that I have taken in from being a victim and now being a survivor and an advocate for others. And my purpose now is empowering other survivors to move on after something so traumatic as sexual violence.
Wow, well, that's such an incredible testament to what you experienced. And I'm thinking, Anna, Lavinia, you said 13 years old, correct?
Yes,
Lavinia,
ma'am.
It occurred.
Yes, ma'am.
Hypothetically speaking, would she have been if she lived in our area, would she have been one of the clients that Consex would have served? I mean, at that young age.
Yes, we at our 9 programs, we have 9 independently operated community-based sexual assault crisis services programs that provide services to every town and every city throughout the entire state of Connecticut. Yeah. And our programs provide services to victims and survivors from literally infancy through old age. We've worked with clients who are as young as just a few months old, providing support to their families and their loved ones in a hospital following an assault, all the way through people in their 80s and 90s. Sexual assault really isn't a crime that discriminates based on any feature, including age. So 13, unfortunately, is an age at which it's not uncommon for people to experience this kind of violence.
Right. Wow. Well, you know, I think prior to us getting into the specifics, I really want to tell people about the SAVE program that you have. But my observation, Anna and Lavinia and Lila, and we talked about this a little bit, is that you have many commonalities. But the thing that struck me is that I see that it's about the timeliness on the one end of the spectrum, Anna, with your SAVE program, and you can talk about that in a minute. You're trying to capture people in the acute phase when the sexual assault or rape happens in the emergency room setting, whereas Lavinia, you're at the other end of the spectrum in that you're trying to prevent the evidence from sitting on the shelf for 20 years like you had to go through that horrific experience. So am I correct in my observation here? It's all about the timeliness of when things have to happen.
Yes. That is so true.
And I would say yes and no. I think
okay.
especially when it comes to the forensic evidence, we're very concerned. There's a very small sort of 48 to 72-hour window for capturing that really good forensic evidence that can lead to convictions, like in Lavinia's case. But our services are available to folks really at all stages of the healing process. That I just want to make sure listeners don't have the idea that, oh, you know, I missed the window, so now this is a burden that I need to bear on my own. Mm-hmm. That
good
there's
point.
Never really a wrong time in the healing process to reach out for services, mm-hmm. even if a statute of limitations has run out, even if the DNA evidence might not exist anymore. There's never a wrong time to decide to talk about your victimization.
Mm-hmm. And that you can still provide them with support and services after
okay.
that window in other aspects.
Absolutely, because there's so much to the healing process beyond just forensic evidence and beyond that criminal justice process. That can be a very healing process for people, but it's also a process that some people opt out of, that it might not be the right thing for them to become involved in the criminal justice system. But there are other ways to heal and other ways to reach out for support and for services. So
right.
I think it's important for folks to know that it's always an option. It's always available.
Exactly. And,
right.
and also piggybacking off what she was saying, as far as my case, my statute of limitations had expired when my case was actually solved. Because
when did it expire, Lavinia?
It had expired 10 years after my sexual assault. But during that time, Texas passed another law, and I had another 10 years after my 18th birthday, but I still missed that window because I had no idea about the rape kit or the DNA. So what
mm-hmm.
happened is I lost all of that, but now that Texas is a no limitations, they don't grandfather back from our crime. So what we did, we took it upon ourselves because now we have these rapists out here, and I'm sorry, I can't help them but call them rapists. I'm one of those that's not politically correct when it comes to that.
That's all right. I'm not either. Go ahead.
But these rapists out here were committing crimes. They had committed these rapes, and Texas, in a sense, was kind of tapping them on their hands and allowing them to plead down. So they were serving time for maybe burglary of habitation or things of that nature, and the rape was not tagged to them. So what we did, other survivors, once we got together and our crimes were being solved through the police department, we got with our DA, Craig Watkins, and he helped us write a law. And in September 2009, we had a law passed where now although the statute of limitations had expired, our DNA evidence is on their DPS records, and if they are out of prison or when they are released or if they commit other crimes, that judge at his discretion can look at that and see that they are capable of doing crimes such as these or if they even commit another offense such as sexual assault. So that was a major accomplishment for
wow.
us, and that was also part of our healing process as well, because it can become disheartening when you realize that you have this forensic evidence, but there's basically nothing you can do with it. And so we mm-hmm. decided, yes, we're going to find something to do with this evidence. And that's exactly what we did. And like she said, there are so many aspects of healing, you know, besides the forensic evidence. And that was just one of the things we were able to do. And it was exciting for us to do that, you know. And we felt we had our day in court when we went before legislation in the House, and they passed the laws and they listened to our testimonies and what have you. So it was part of our healing process as well.
Sure. Well, can you tell me just briefly, and then we're going to get into maybe to talk about some of the myths, but have other states in that predicament, so to speak, also looked into that legislation and maybe tried to adopt it, as far as you know, other than Texas?
As far as we know, those that because many states already had no limits. But
okay.
as far as we know, there are other states that are contacting us. I've even had them contact me because maybe they want me to share my testimony to help them get their bill passed. I also worked with Lisa Madigan out of Illinois with a process, a law that she helped pass because they see what we're doing here in Texas, and they're trying to make it work in their states. So there are other states that are, if they're not trying to adopt the same thing, they're trying to figure out ways to make it happen almost similar to the way we made
Great.
It happen here.
Great. Well, yes. We have to, you know, wouldn't it be wonderful if all of the crime victimizations, we had a uniform way of dealing with everything, but we have,
yes.
you know, at least 50 different ways to do everything, and that makes
exactly.
it so hard.
Yes,
Anna, can you talk to us a little bit with respect to what are some of the myths that people hold with respect to sexual assault and rape? I mean, maybe the media has portrayed it all in you know, a convoluted way, and we need to get the truth out there. So can you speak to that for us?
Sure. I think there are so many assaults that I like to talk about the myths that we believe in a few different ways. One is that these myths are kind of out there and they're things that we hear, but at some point we start to internalize those myths. And I think there's some really interesting reasons for why we really want to believe the myths that we hold on to. I think some of the biggest myths that are out there, one is that victims and survivors are assaulted by strangers. I remember, you know, growing up, there was sort of the stranger danger lesson
right.
that children were always taught in school, that, you know, don't get in the car with a stranger, don't, you know, be careful of people who look shady. But we don't often teach our children, be careful of people you know, about people who have
mm-hmm.
access to you.
Right.
We know that, you know, between 80 and 90% of sexual assault survivors were assaulted by somebody who they knew, whether it was a family member, an acquaintance, or, you know, a friend
of a
parent.
So that was 80 to 90%, you said?
80 to 90%, depending on which study you look at, but a majority
right.
of victims do know their offenders prior to the assault. And I think, you know, going back to what I mentioned about why we like to believe these myths, I think it's just easier for us as adults to talk to children in a way that says, you know, be careful of strangers. It's a much harder message to say, you know, be careful of me. Be careful of, you know, Uncle Timmy. Be careful of the people who, you know, we've chosen to let into our lives. That's a very
yeah.
scary thought, to know that the
sure.
people that we trust and care about could hurt us. But the reality is that's what this looks like a majority of the time.
So look both ways before you cross the street, and make sure that you tell me when Uncle Tim asks you an inappropriate question or something. It's got to be very challenging to
mm-hmm.
you know, to be a parent these days to do those. What are a couple other myths that you can tell us?
Another one that kind of comes to mind is a lot of the myths that we hold about who offenders are and therefore who survivors are. I think we have this idea that offenders are really easy to identify, that, you know, it's the stranger with candy, or it's somebody who, you know, looks really creepy. I think we have this idea, in part from television and in part because of what we see on the news, and again, in part because of who we choose or not choose to associate with ourselves. I think there's this idea that, you know, nice guys or nice women can't be offenders, that I've heard of so many really heartbreaking cases where a child will disclose that abuse occurred, and they'll be told, you know, well, but that's the school principal, that's, you know, the priest, that's a really well-respected doctor. You can't speak out against this person because they have a certain position of privilege within the community. So I think a lot of victims believe that myth, and if the victims and survivors themselves, they know who their offenders are, but that's a myth that society uses to silence a lot of people who don't have as much privilege or who don't
right.
have a lot of access.
Right.
So,
well, either
I think,
of it, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, you know, so that also kind of feeds into who we view as survivors, that, you know, survivors, just like we have these myths about who offenders are,
mm-hmm.
we hear all of these myths about, you know, well, a sexual assault victim is a woman who was drinking, or somebody who, you know, was out late or in the wrong place, or, you know, if only she
right.
hadn't been wearing that outfit, this wouldn't have happened.
Right.
So we
mm-hmm.
we're really willing to take a lot of the onus of the crime off of the offender, that, well, he's a good guy, this must have been a mistake, and we
right.
say, well, you know, but look at this victim, she made a bad choice, therefore this crime was inevitable somehow, when something that I tell folks when I do education out in the community is that, you know what, if you change any circumstance of a victim or survivor, that assault is inevitable, that I can go outside and I can be drunk and I can be naked and it can be a bad neighborhood at 2 o'clock in the morning, and if the first person who runs into me is a good person who helps me and takes care of me, I'm not going to be assaulted. But you know, by the same token, I can be fully clothed 2 o'clock in the afternoon in my own home, but if a rapist walks into the room, I can be a victim. It has nothing to do with my behavior. It's never a choice
right.
The survivor makes. It's a choice that the perpetrator makes.
Yeah, that is so true. And I'm wondering, you know, with your particular circumstance when you were 13, Lavinia, I'm sure you would agree with those myths. Do you have some ideas in terms of how do we, I mean, maybe through your ministries, you and your support group that you run, how do you try to correct those myths?
Basically, as she was speaking, the same way you try to dismiss them, you inform survivors. First of all, it was never their fault. That is a guilt that we carry for so long because I carried that as a victim myself. That, you know, we begin to blame ourselves because of how society, I think, displays everything and puts the ownership on us as a victim. As maybe if I wasn't sleeping a certain way, there was no way I could have prevented what happened to me that night. But I began to internalize everything and think maybe, you know, he saw me outside, or maybe I had shorts on one day standing outside of my door, or if I would have done this, or, you know, and all this. It was craziness for me to think that way, but there was nothing I could have done to prevent that. But what I do when I have my meetings, or I try to speak to survivors or victims about it, I try to, you know, first let them know it was not their fault. There was nothing they could do to prevent it. And as she was speaking earlier, I just had an incident yesterday with a young girl, that I care about a lot, and she was talking to her mom. She had went somewhere, and she said, "Mom, we have a secret." She was saying the person had told her that, you know, that they have a secret, and she can't tell anyone. And I told her, I said, "You know what? You never keep secrets from your mom, ever." I said, "I don't care what anybody tell you, you know." Mm-hmm. And I said, "You don't have to say it around me." I said, "But never keep secrets from your mom, you know." And her mom was like, "Yeah, that is so true." And so when she walked away, I said, "You know, a lot of times it's how predators, that's how they begin with your children, you know, is
right.
I have a secret, you know, let's keep our secrets." So these little things that a lot of times people don't pay attention to, you try to bring it out in the forefront so they can, you know, they can see the different things. Because like Anna said, it's not always the stranger. Although my assailant was a stranger that broke into my home, sometimes it's those that's living in the same house with you, or your neighbor or your friend, or your trusted, your loved ones, and things you have to be aware for about, and you have to look out for some things that just don't look right, you know.
Right.
You know, sometimes I tell parents, I say, you know, he's a stepdad, and not saying that he's going to do anything to your little girl, but, you know, at some point you should say, I don't think I should let him bathe her, you know. And I'm not saying be paranoid, just be cautious, you know, because
well,
you never know.
You know, those of us who are baby boomers, you know, growing up, I never had to seemingly worry about that or that, you know, go outside and play or run down the block, and you never had to worry about those concerns. And it's just a whole different world out there. And those of you who are parents and grandparents, of which I am not, but I work with people with multiple disabilities who are very vulnerable, and I see their shattered lives every day, and it just breaks your heart that you have to be an enforcer of all of these things, you know? Maybe this is a good juncture here. Anna, I want you to tell us about the innovative program that Consex does in terms of even if it's on a limited basis, it's not throughout the whole state of Connecticut in terms of hospitals. Can you illuminate us in terms of the SAFE program and what it's about?
Sure. The SAFE program is sort of the abbreviated title of a wonderful program that has a bit of a cumbersome name. It's the official name of the program is the State of Connecticut Judicial Branch Office of Victim Services Gailburn Smith Sexual Assault Forensic Examiners Program. It's a bit of a mouthful. We just call it the SAFE program. But it's a program that's run through the Connecticut Office of Victim Services. It's named for Gail Burns Smith, who was the first executive director of Connecticut Sexual Assault Crisis Services. And the program provides participating hospitals with 24/7 access to sexual assault forensic examiners. These sexual assault forensic examiners, or SAFEs, are healthcare providers who are specially trained to use evidence collection kits to gather forensic evidence following an assault. So the SAFE program currently provides services to adult and adolescent victims ages 13 and up at 6 hospitals in the central Connecticut area. So we have 6 hospitals that signed on to be part of this initial rollout of the program. We tried to pick kind of a pilot area that included urban hospitals, suburban hospitals, and one more rural hospital, just to get a sense of how the program would play out, how victims would access the program, how it would function. You know, how does the program mm-hmm. work in a very busy emergency room as opposed to, you know, a less busy rural hospital?
Right. So what was the situation before you had these services available? What is the difference?
So in a majority of hospitals in Connecticut, and then in all hospitals prior to the program, it's incumbent on hospitals to provide doctors or nurses to go through an evidence collection kit. And I'll back up a little bit just to talk about what that is.
Right.
Immediately following a sexual assault, sexual assault is a really unique crime in that the victim's body is itself the crime scene, that there's not, you know, necessarily a location that you can go to and put up, you know, the yellow police tape and conduct a real thorough investigation. The crime scene is, in fact, the victim's body, and our bodies are things that are always changing and always cleaning themselves and, you know, always in different physical states. So following a sexual assault, for any kind of good forensic evidence from the perpetrator to still be on the victim, there's about a 72-hour window when that evidence can be collected, whether it's saliva or semen or blood or any kind of other bodily fluid. You know, sometimes there are cases where you might have a hair sample from the offender somewhere on the victim's body. So the goal of evidence collection kits is to make sure that that evidence is taken from the crime scene, from the victim's body, and preserved and analyzed in a way that can eventually be used to identify a perpetrator and then ideally convict them. So the evidence collection kit, it changed recently. I believe now it's a 13-step process. Unfortunately, it's a bit of an invasive procedure. But when a victim or survivor, and I should note I use victim and survivor interchangeably. I feel really uncomfortable just using one word or the other, and I know that comes from years of working with victims and survivors who choose different words, so I want to make sure I cover both
That's
bases.
Fine.
The
That's
language.
Fine. Yep.
But when a victim goes to an emergency room following an assault, they're asked to undress. Any clothing that might have potential forensic evidence on it is collected, so underwear, pants, sometimes everything that a victim's wearing. Some of the steps included in the kit, they do oral swabs that are just sort of big Q-tips that might be swabbed on the inside of a victim's cheek and around their mouth to try to gather any evidence that might be there. There are vaginal and anal swabs to try to collect any evidence that might be in those areas. The kit includes head hair samples. There's a lot of really great DNA that can be found in head hair as well as pubic hair. Those hairs are analyzed at the crime lab. And then again, I'm not a nurse or a scientist, so I can't give, you know, a great scientific explanation of how that DNA
right.
evidence, you know, is then used to track back to perpetrators.
Sure. We can call our friend Tim Pombach, who we had on a couple weeks ago. He's a good consultant for us. But yeah, so we're sort of getting the idea that, you know, it has to be invasive because it is an invasive crime, but it's very, it must be very, very traumatic. And I'm thinking to myself, prior to the people coming in, did they have to sit in an emergency room, maybe even in the chairs, as they call them, before they get into a room that's curtained sitting there for 8 hours because they triage and maybe it's not the most important if someone is dying and not be able to cleanse themselves, take a shower. I mean, I can't imagine going through that. Is that why these people are there, these specially trained nurses 24/7, and they can just come in immediately and assist them?
Yeah, you're exactly right. Without an established sexual assault forensic examiner program in place, because victims are seeking out services in a hospital emergency room, this is the same place where people who are having strokes and heart attacks and you who have been injured in car accidents and really need that immediate life or death care. In a way, any patient in an emergency room is sort of competing for those limited emergency room resources. So what would happen, a sexual assault is an incredibly just terrible trauma for people to experience, but if a victim waits half an hour or 7 hours, it's not typically life or death. So what we found is that victims were going to the emergency room. When they arrive, they're told, we don't want anything to hurt the evidence, so don't eat, don't drink, don't use the restroom, don't shower before you come to the hospital. So victims are very physically uncomfortable because of the assault, and then because they're hungry, because they need to urinate, because they'd like a drink of water, and they're being told, wait until someone becomes available. So we have victims waiting sometimes 5, 6, 7, 8 hours until emergency room staff became available. And one of the complications with that is because evidence collection and preservation is such a delicate thing scientifically, once you pull a doctor or a nurse out of the emergency room, kind of off the ER floor to do this kit, that same healthcare provider has to be the one doing the kit from start to finish. So if you only have 2 emergency room doctors or you only have 3 nurses on staff, then you're taking that person away from any heart attack or stroke or any other patient that comes in after that point.
The staffing issue is very critical. So I would imagine these nurses, it's very good that they're there just for that sole purpose. Is that right?
That's correct. The way that it works, there's an on-call rotation. I wish I had the exact number off the top of my head, but I think we're close to around 30 nurses who are part of the program at this point. They have an on-call rotation, so they're really committed to being available when they're on the schedule. So a victim will arrive at the hospital, and then the hospital triage will call the number that we have set up for these safe nurses. The safes are supposed to arrive at the hospital within an hour of being called. And one of the great things about this program is that when the nurse is called, the nurse also calls a sexual assault crisis counselor, an advocate from the local program. So they respond in tandem. So not only is the victim receiving services within an hour of showing up at the hospital, they're also receiving those services from a highly specialized, highly trained nurse who's going to be able to provide prompt and compassionate care, but they're also...
Oh, that's excellent.
Yeah, so it makes the experience a bit less traumatic to have such a specially trained person there, and you also have the added bonus of having an advocate there who can take care of some of the additional needs. So, once that oral swab is done, the nurse can't necessarily leave the room, but the advocate's able to say, now I can go get you a glass of water, I can get you a sandwich. If the forensic examiner needs something, the advocate's available to kind of help on the side there. And the advocate's also able to tie that survivor into services that can last for years beyond that point. You can have an advocate who's saying, I'm here for you today in this moment, in this point of crisis, but I'm going to be there tomorrow. And if you want to talk in a week, I'll be there. And if you're supposed to trial, I'll be there.
That is wonderful to have somebody throughout the whole process, and I hope that we get more funding from the state to continue this so it's beyond the pilot program.
Yes.
Really do.
Donna, I wanted to add, she was speaking. I served on both ends of the spectrum. I was once that victim that sat in that emergency room in the middle of the hallway for all those hours.
Did you? Okay.
Yes, ma'am. It was a horrific experience. Oh. I remember it like it was yesterday.
Tell us a little bit about that, the aftermath of the crime.
The aftermath, I call it my second re-victimization is what I call it. because of how you're already afraid. You're a child. You don't know what's going on. Here are the police asking you a million and one questions. You're riding in the squad car to the county hospital because that's where they would take you back in the day in 85. And once you get there, you're sitting on a gurney in the middle of the hallway, police surrounding you, asking you questions. Everybody's walking by wondering what happened, what did she do. You feel like you're a criminal, and there's no privacy. They're asking you questions out in the open. And then here comes a male doctor. His hands are bigger than anything you've ever seen. There was no sympathy. There was no, I'm like, where's the woman? Where's a nurse? Where's somebody who's concerned about me, who really wants to know what happened, who's here to help me? And it was very scary, and I will never forget that experience. And then the program you guys have in Connecticut is one that we have here in Texas, and I'm actually a SART member. We call it a sexual assault response team member. So I'm one of the advocates that goes out to the hospital when someone is sexually assaulted. So they
wonderful. Great.
Yes, ma'am. And so it is, I love it. I wish they had this program back when it happened to me. But to, like she said, when a victim is there and they see you come in as an advocate, taking time out of your busy schedule, and then most importantly, when they find out that you are also a survivor, it means so much to them. It gives them so much hope knowing that, hey, maybe I will make it through this. And it is a wonderful program. Another thing we also have in Texas is we've started creating the serenity rooms at the hospitals, where the hospital wings are making like suites for the victims to give them more privacy. They are so beautiful.
Do with maternity, Lavinia?
Exactly. And they have a room for your family, for you, the police, to ask questions. It's beautiful. They call them serenity rooms. And I think you can probably see some of them online, but they are putting those up in the hospitals. But it is such a wonderful program to have these
now,
safe programs.
How extensive is your program? Is it a certain pilot hospitals there, or is it throughout the state of Texas?
It's pretty set throughout the state of Texas. They started it, I know it's been going on, I know at least 4 years. I want to say at least 4 years. So it's pretty set. It's pretty set with the program, and it's wonderful. It's wonderful because they got the opinions and the feedback from victims and what they wanted and what they needed, and they adhere to that. So, it's an awesome program. I love it. I love it. I love it. And recommend it for every state to pick it and adopt this program for victims, because you have no idea the difference that it makes the victims' lives to have these same nurses to be there on a dime. I mean, as soon as they call, they're there. And then to have an advocate there as well, and that support system is what they need, because a victim is terrified. I was terrified that night, to know now, and sometimes I still tear up when I get a call to go, because it's so uplifting to me to be able to give back, and I missed it. I say myself, I refuse to allow another victim to miss what we have now and what the services that we're trying to offer them. It's a wonderful program.
Well, that's the right attitude. Anna, do we have any serenity rooms in Connecticut?
Not that I know of.
Well, let's talk to Governor Malloy.
Yes.
Although they have made good changes. Now, before it used to be that victims would just be in whatever space was available, they'd pull a curtain around them. But now victims do have the right to request a private room when they're in the hospital. But
that's not good enough. Lavinia, I'm sharing your phone number with Governor Malloy.
That sounds incredible. I'd love to see that for survivors.
It should be a news story online. We did one of them with the Serenity Room, and it tours the hospital and the different rooms. So you should be able to find it online. If I find it, I'll also send it to you later.
Good.
Let's
share it. Delilah, can you join the conversation here? And should we ask Lavinia about her experiences in Africa? Or I want you to share some of your questions as well.
Oh, absolutely. I think the biggest question that I have is going back to, how many times our system re-victimizes a victim. And not just in sexual assault cases, but many other types of cases as well. And I'm wondering, I know in our state there was just something recently that kind of goes back to what Lavinia was talking about with the with the perpetrators, you know, being out on a lesser charge or however this happens. We also have a problem with them bonding out. By the time that their bonds are so low that they're able to make the bond, and by the time, you know, they're getting out and their court dates come up, is sometimes quite a long time. And in the meantime, they're out there committing more crimes.
Mm-hmm. Good point. What's the answer, ladies?
The discouraging thing to me is that, you know, the things that are going on to help these victims is wonderful. And the hard work that people like Anna and Lavinia and all of the organizations across the country do to help these victims as much as they possibly can. And when they get into the court system, it seems like there again, there's another place where society lets them down so badly in some cases that, you know, it's very hard to heal from something like that. And I'm sure Lavinia can speak to how it was in South Africa, which I'm sure it's twice as worse as it is here.
Yeah. What was that like, Lavinia? I'm sure on many levels it was just, you know, an experience you'll never forget.
How did you
happen to go to Africa? Maybe you should start there, because you know why pick it? You were invited, correct?
Yes, I was invited to South Africa. I was invited by Chris Asplund, who was the Assistant Attorney General under Janet Reno and the Clinton administration, and they are trying to get DNA for Africa just like they do DNA here in the United States as far as helping victims. Because as you know and everybody knows, that sexual violence is prevalent in South Africa. It is prevalent. And so they were looking for, and I'm not trying to toot my horn or pat myself on the back, but they wanted a strong advocate, someone that didn't have fear when it came to dealing with talking and facing sexual assault. And he said my name resounded three times when he was looking for a survivor. And I felt honored. I felt honored that people looked at me in that way, because I do like to tackle this head on when it comes to talking about sexual violence. So when he called me, it was kind of funny because, you know, in Texas we have like Paris, Texas, we have London, Texas. So when he said he wanted me to come to South Africa, I go, South Africa, Texas? And he laughed at me because I was like, there's no way he's talking about South Africa, South Africa. But indeed he was, and they have formed a team. And I'm bad with my memory, but Ed with Bodie Technologies, we call him Ed. I can't remember his last name, but Professor, I can't remember their names. I'm sorry, but he's with the one of the Innocent Project. He's one of the founders of the Innocent Project for Wisconsin, and Chris Aston, of course, and we were the speakers over there, talking about DNA and the importance of DNA. And when I got to South Africa, I thought, to be quite honest, that I was the least of them to go because of, you know, their backgrounds and their law degrees and juris doctors.
You mean their credentials?
Oh,
no,
exactly. And so it was amazing because I actually missed my first flight because I had no idea it was going to take me 3 hours to actually get through my luggage trying to get out of the United States. And
wow.
I, when I called them, I was disheartened, and they were like, no, Lavinia, you are the reason that we are doing this. You have to be here. You have to come. You know, they were like, get on the next plane. Whatever they had to do, they wanted it done. And so when I got there, I was received as almost held as some sort of God. You know, it was amazing because
Like royalty.
Yes, and that's what the magistrates, I can't remember the name they gave me, but they crowned me as royalty because of what I'm doing for victims and for me to come and speak, knowing how it is in South Africa and knowing how women dare speak out about this and healing and trying to do something about it.
Did they want you to speak as an inspirational speaker and to tell your personal story?
They wanted me to share my personal story. They wanted to share, most importantly, how DNA changed my life. And indeed it did, because they are fighting. They have been fighting for 10 years to try to get DNA to be used over in South Africa, because, they're finding that it would bring a lot of people down, even in high places, as far as these sexual violence crimes. And as I speak, after each engagement, you have doctors, you have people in the psychology field, you have, everybody coming to you, and they have been victims themselves, and they are, although they're working to try to make change, they are still amazed at how I am up speaking about this. And it was, that meant so much to me. That meant so much to me to know that people need that encouragement. They need that empowerment to know that there is life and we can stand up and we can be survivors and be strong and hold our head up high. We don't have to be shamed and we don't have to gray out my face or digitize my voice when I'm talking or just show my hands on TV, because I'm no longer that victim. I am
very good. We're proud of you, Lavinia. That's just totally amazing. And if you had to summarize in a minute or so, we've got about 14 minutes left. What is the bottom line in terms of how far do they have to go from this juncture to get DNA? How much progress have they made since you've been there and currently? Then I want to go back to Anna and ask her a couple things too as well.
In South Africa, I would say it's pretty much the same. It made an impact. It's not as slow as it was at first. It is starting to make some noise, and people are starting to hear it in the right places. Is what Chris shared with me. And they are making some progress. Some things that didn't happen before has now happened, and more opportunities are opening up for them to make some sort of change. So he said that is good news for him, because before he said it was like total silence. They just disregarded them totally. And they shared with me that they really appreciate what I did, because they felt within their hearts that if a victim did not come and speak about what DNA can do and how it can change their lives,
they wouldn't have hope, right?
They wouldn't have hope. And so that's exciting to know, with the forensic work that's going on, not only in South Africa, but at home in the United States, of the things it can do. And another thing real quick, and I'm going to shut up, what I just came back in February from Washington, D.C., I was invited to speak at with the Department of Justice and the victims. What do you call it? I'm sorry, I'm so bad. The Office of Violence. Yeah, of women. We had a roundtable discussion during a 3-year study of trying to figure out on a national level we can work with this DNA and approaching victims and helping victims. And they wanted some who feel that it's not so hot, and those who say, okay, it's empowered and changed me, and what can we do to, because we have a huge rape kit backlog that they're trying to solve, and they're trying to figure out the correct way to do it. And there's always going to be, trial and error. There's always going to be issues in the end, but it's an awesome experience to work in these fields and try to help victims in DNA and forensic science.
So you feel like by going... going to Washington, you made some inroads there. At least you exchanged ideas.
Yes.
And they're going to take it and do some legislation on the federal level?
Yes, they're doing some legislation on the federal level. We're still going back and forth in discussions and emails and different questions and ideas. And it's awesome, because it is making a difference. It's making a change. And when you do that, you make a change in those victims' lives, and you help get them on the road to recovery of healing and making them survivors.
Right, the Delilah and people and her, they always say that we're the experts, and we have a hard time dealing with that we're the experts, but we are, I guess, in our respective victimization fields. But so that was just such an empowering description, and I'm so glad you shared that. And Anna, you deal with public policy at CONSACS, and I know that The legislature is about to wind down in Connecticut, but there are a couple of laws that you were advocating for, and one of them in particular I wanted to ask you about. There's a loophole. There was one in terms of an act concerning sexual people who have disabilities and assaulting people who have disabilities and inability to communicate. And I wondered if you could tell us about that law, because from my research, I understand that there were two convicted offenders who assaulted people with disabilities, and they were released from prison. What did you try to do with respect to supporting that law?
Sure. Actually, a couple quick thoughts.
Sure.
Kind of going, transitioning into the talk about public policy. Everything Lavinia said is so true and so important for survivors to understand that, you know, I do the public policy work for Connecticut Sexual Assault Crisis Services, and I would say almost without exception, all of the change that happens related to sexual violence is survivor-driven, it's survivor-led, whether it's CONSACs, you're hearing stories from the survivors that come to our programs or survivors contacting legislators directly, that's how change is made, that survivors are 100% the experts of their own experience. No one has better credentials for being agents of change when it comes to sexual assault policy and response than survivors.
We appreciate that because sometimes we forget.
Yeah, oh, it's so important to remember. But this act that you're talking about, it did come from something that was a court case that came out of Bridgeport, Connecticut in, I think, 2009. What happened, there was a woman who had very severe intellectual disabilities and some associated physical disabilities, and she had been assaulted by her mother's boyfriend. The case went to trial. He was convicted. He went away to prison, appealed the decision, and the Connecticut Appellate Court took a look at the way that Connecticut sexual assault statutes, I think in this case it was sexual assault in the second degree, they looked at the wording of the statute and said, this offender was sent to prison on the basis of the fact that he assaulted a woman who, I hate this phrase, but in statute it says you can't have intercourse or sexual contact with a person who's physically helpless. And the state of Connecticut defines physical helplessness as being unconscious or for any other reason unable to communicate, lack of consent. So in this case, the woman was completely nonverbal, unable to communicate except through gestures and through using a communication board where she'd point at pictures and words
right.
to communicate her thoughts.
Right.
The appellate court said, well, she's not actually physically helpless. She's able to communicate. She's able to make gestures, and I hate this. I boil over with rage every time I even talk about this case. But the court said, you know what? This woman's capable of biting, kicking, and screeching, and that's a form of communication. And because she didn't bite, kick, or screech while she was being sexually assaulted, she didn't try hard enough to say no.
Are you serious?
I'm completely serious. I've cried over this. It's disgusting. And you know, so basically through that court decision, the Connecticut court said, you know what? We're creating two different standards. We're saying that if you're an able-bodied person, you know, there's one standard, but if you're a person who has a disability, you darn well better try to communicate in any way available to you. You know, if you have to bite your offender, do it. That's what we expect of you, which is just horrendous.
But maybe cognitively, she wasn't, as a former speech pathologist, I know, maybe cognitively and intellectually, she wasn't able to call upon those means to do that. So, you know, that just makes me livid.
It's horrible. So this is the third year in a row that we've been trying to revise those standards. statute so that it covers people who the problem with the
multiple
statute right now, right, is that it's so extreme that you have to be completely unable to communicate. So what we're trying to do is to say if you have any kind of disability, whether it's physical, intellectual, mental, that impedes your ability to communicate consent, you know what? It's not up to you to have to fight to say no. If whoever wants to have any kind of sexual contact with you needs to be very clear about making sure that you understand the situation and that you're consenting to it. So the onus is no longer on a person with a disability who's expected to bite their offender. I mean, it's absurd. So we're trying to put language in the statute that says, you know, if a person doesn't understand what's going on enough to consent, or if they're unable to communicate a positive consent, if they're unable to communicate yes, then you can't have sexual contact with that person. So we've been very careful. We've worked closely with our Chief State's Attorney's Office, the prosecutors in the state, with our Office of Protection and Advocacy, the Connecticut Council on Developmental Disabilities, Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services. We have a really amazing coalition of disability advocates, of prosecutors, of sexual assault crisis counselors who have worked hard to get this language into place. And we're close.
I
feel like we're very close to passing it.
Yeah, well, that's good. I certainly hope we cover that loophole. And because it was so, you know, bizarre, I wanted to make sure that we brought this up. And I certainly hope that other states will look at their legislation in view of this experience. And we have just a couple of minutes. I want to know, can you each give contact information as well as tell me what would be your parting words of advice, whether it be local or national, with respect to the topics that we've discussed tonight? Any parting words of something that you haven't covered that you'd like to convey? Lavinia.
Okay, I guess I will go first. Well, my parting words I would like to convey is, like I said, my purpose, I feel, in life is to empower survivors and to help them realize from that place of being a victim to knowing that they are a survivor. So my parting word to them is to just let them know, like I always say, there is hope for the hopeless. They don't have to continue to live in the state that they are in. There are so many resources out there, like Anna was speaking about, what Connecticut is doing and what we do here in Texas. And in every state, there are all kind of resources available for you. There's counseling, there's therapy. A lot of it is free when you've been a victim. You know, there's people like me that talk to you and try to guide you through the process. Yes, yes.
Right.
And just knowing that you can come from that state of being that victim and being a survivor, it's a beautiful thing. I love it.
It
I wouldn't
well,
trade
how
it
can
for
people
the
get in touch with you? How can people get in touch with you, Lavinia,
They can go to my website at saveministry.org. That's S like Sam, A V like Victor E, ministry.org.
Yep.
Or they can call me at 214-810-7398. That's my ministry line. Or email me, laviniamasters@gmail.com.
Super. Now, Anna, what would you, can you please give us your parting thoughts and some contact information quickly?
Sure. I'll start with the contact information. In Connecticut, we have two toll-free confidential 24/7 hotlines. The English hotline is 888-999-5545. And we also have a Spanish hotline. That number is 888-568-8332. Those numbers only work if you're calling from within Connecticut. So if you're listening to this in another state and you need help contacting services in your own area, you can call the contact office at 860-282-9881. Ask for me, ask for Anna. I'll do everything I can to help you connect with programs and services in your area. As far as parting thoughts, just to wrap up some of what we've talked about already in this conversation, I think it's so important to know that it's okay to talk about this. It's okay whether this is an experience that you've had personally, whether it's something that you've had no personal experience with. It's an issue that we need to talk about and that survivors need to understand. Oh, we do take volunteers, yes. We offer training for people.
We've got about 1 minute. I'm sorry. Go ahead. So you do take volunteers, and you're talking about empowerment as well as Lavinia. And I'm really sorry to cut you off. I just want to be able to thank both of you from the bottom of my heart. I think this is a wonderful show. Please pass it along. Everyone, please tell everyone to listen on the archives. Delilah, thank you so much for producing and being a part of the show as well. And please go to my website, www.donnagore.com, and visit ImaginePublicity.com. They're fabulous. And please, everyone, remember that when it comes to helping survivors of crime, don't just try, make it happen. And so, Anna and Lavinia, please, I hope you'll keep in touch with me, and
yes,
we can accomplish great things together, okay?
Yes, ma'am. Appreciate
thank
you. Thank you.
Very good. So we'll be, thank you. We'll be signing off, and everyone, please look for a blog soon. We'll tell you what's been happening, and be sure and tune in next week for another great show. Thank you so much, and good evening.